Down south, they say it's the economy, stupid. Up here, we say it's the economy, eh? And this is Political Economy Radio, a progressive take on economic issues in Canada and beyond. My name is Michał Rozworski, and welcome to the show. Two guests this week on two different topics, but both of very immediate interest. First, Harsha Valia, author of Undoing Border Imperialism, and longtime anti-racist and migrant rights activist, discusses the changes that have occurred in Canada's immigration system over the past decade of conservative rule. Of course, we also touch on Canada's response to the refugee crisis and the heartening refugees welcome protests, in which Harsha had no small role. My second guest, Roger Rachy, speaks to me about the coming wave of protests in Quebec and what is shaping up to be a hot autumn in that province. Roger is a longtime political and social activist in Quebec, and he presently works for Alternative in Montreal. First, however, my conversation with Harsha Valia.
You are one of the lead organizers and authors behind the Never Home report that is really comprehensive and documents these really big changes in Canada's immigration policy over the past decades. Maybe first just lay out what some of these major changes are and how they sort of fit together.
Yeah, I think the main changes in immigration over the past decade can probably be summarized in two ways. One is that immigration to Canada has increasingly become temporary. So the idea of permanent residency, you know, which is what people imagine immigration as, which is, you know, the idea that people come as immigrants or refugees or skilled workers, all the various channels that there are, and are able to gain permanent residency and then eventual citizenship, right? So it's a permanent move to a new place, if you will. But since 2008, the number of people who come to Canada are, the majority of those are temporary residents. So they come on temporary permits. And currently in Canada, the number of temporary permits, not including visitors and even international students, is approximately 400,000. And the number of people who come as permanent residents is approximately 250,000. So increasingly, we're seeing a shift towards temporariness rather than permanent residency in Canada. So that's one major shift. And obviously, that has, you know, significant consequences that we can touch on later. And the second major shift is that for people who are able to access permanent residency, so for, you know, those 250,000 or so people, that permanent residency is increasingly becoming conditional. So, for example, if you are sponsoring your spouse, then in most cases, that spouse is on a conditional residency for 2 years before they can access permanent residency. So it's like a probationary period. And that leaves particularly immigrant women really vulnerable, because if they're trying to leave an abusive relationship, then they're at risk of deportation. So increasingly, avenues that do grant permanent residency have a number of conditions attached to them. And even for those who become citizens, citizenship is also becoming conditional, right? So there's been a new law passed called the Stealing Citizenship Act, or, well, that's what we call it. And that means that the Canadian government can revoke people's permanent people's citizenship under a number of circumstances. So basically, we're seeing permanent residency rights gutted. So either there's no access to permanent residency and you're only coming on a temporary permit, or even if you are able to gain access to permanent residency, then you're at greater risk of losing it.
Yeah, and it seems like this change in immigration policy sort of in some ways mirrors this other trend that's maybe sort of being felt generally towards sort of greater precarity elsewhere in the economy, you know, temporary work and all things like that. How important are migrant workers, you know, what the government calls so-called temporary foreign workers, to this new immigration policy? And what's the role sort of the temporariness?
Yeah, temporariness is really central to immigration policy, particularly because it connects largely to the way in which the political economy is increasingly structured. So a few examples. One is, of course, migrant workers. So migrant workers, temporary foreign workers, as the program is called, particularly low-wage workers, come under what's called the temporary foreign worker program. And they work in sectors like domestic work, retail work, farm work, doing, you know, really hard work, working in dangerous conditions, working overtime, are often paying into social programs. So in the case of farm workers, for example, paying into the EI program, but not able to access it. Migrant workers don't have a right to collective representation, whether it's through unions or otherwise. And so, you know, what migrant workers, particularly low-wage migrant workers, form is a pool of cheap labor. And, you know, this is a deliberately created program by the state to serve capital interests, because migrant workers, what makes them so precarious is the fact that they are indentured to a single employer. So their visa is contingent on remaining with their employer. And so, you know, they can't leave their employer. And if they raise any concerns or complaints with their employer, then they're either blacklisted or deported. So what the migrant workers as a program and as a pool of labor do is that they ensure the lowering of the wage floor, essentially, right? Because also migrant workers are frequently paid less than minimum wage, despite there being a requirement that they be paid at least a prevailing wage. But of course, given their precarity, that's never enforced. And furthermore, most migrant workers report working an average of 12 to 14 hours a day. So again, because there is no protection, there's no labor protections and or ability to enforce labor protections, they're very precarious. So definitely migrant workers are central to creating pools of labor that are increasingly flexible, precarious. The other thing that this kind of temporariness allows for in the context of the political economy is also privatization. So for example, for parents and grandparents who used to come to Canada as permanent residents under the Family Reunification Program, because they're now coming under temporary permits, it means that they have to pre-purchase private Canadian health insurance. So what this visa program, which is called the Super Visa Program, what it's done is it's actually opening the door further to the privatization of universal public health care. So one of the largest increases in private Canadian health care that we're seeing in Canada, and you know, not even a lot of health care organizations are talking about this, or health organizations are talking about this, is actually insurance companies that are selling private Canadian insurance to immigrants who can only come here if they purchase this, right? So we're seeing the eroding of public systems that people take for granted, like healthcare, education, childcare, and other things, through the ways in which the immigration system is increasingly structured as a for-profit system, and a system that by using and by justifying and coding immigrants as stealing resources is increasingly pushing for immigrants to pre-purchase and or purchase the kinds of services that should be public. And so that's opening up the door for privatization and further austerity generally.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned this kind of language of stealing resources, which is very prevalent. And I mean, you see it everywhere. Even some trade unions have campaigned on this as, you know, we want jobs for Canadians and this kind of rhetoric. It seems that migration functions as another sort of divide and conquer sort of strategy that just pits people against each other and, you know, enforces kind of scarcity where there might not be any. How do we counteract this? How do we counteract these kinds of divisions that elites are sowing, that in fact, yeah, lower conditions for everyone?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few different ways to respond to that, and I think they go together, particularly when it comes to immigrant seniors, for example. The prevailing idea is that they're draining our healthcare system. When it comes to refugees, the idea is typically that they're draining our welfare programs. When it comes to migrant workers, it's that they're stealing jobs. So yeah, this idea overall of stealing or taking away or draining from of what's ours. So the few responses I think are, you know, first of all, it's actually not even factually accurate. There's been, you know, numerous studies over the past years that show that actually refugees and immigrants have, for example, a much lower rate of accessing social assistance than most Canadians do. I mean, of course, I believe they have a right to access it if they want, but it's not true. It's not factually accurate. The second is that it's actually important to know that it's the inverse. It's not only that our migrants not using public resources, if you will, but they're actually contributing to it and subsidizing it. So in the case I gave of migrant workers, for example, who are farm workers, they're actually paying into EI but are not able to access it, which means that the EI purse, if you will, is actually subsidized by migrant workers. And when we look at parents and grandparents who are coming to Canada, an overwhelming amount of them are performing child care and domestic labor, which is also a subsidy. You know, parents and caregivers are able to enter into the paid economy. And also it means that the government is off the hook in some ways from providing universal child care, right? Because they're increasingly relying on grandparents to perform that domestic labor in the kind of privatized sphere of the home. The last strategy, which is the more substantive one, is again looking at how this economy is, or rather the role that immigration plays in the economy is really bound up into a broader picture, both at the national level and the global level, right? Which is that the divisiveness that's being created between people in Canada, particularly working people and immigrants and refugees and migrant workers, is a very strategic one by elites, right? By both the state and capital, who on the one hand benefit from migrant labor and migrant work, yet on the other hand want to ensure that those divisions continue so that migrant workers remain in a precarious state. So a lot of labor unions, for example, have been advocating, and even, you know, parties like the NDP have been advocating for the abolition of the temporary foreign worker program. And certainly the temporary foreign worker program shouldn't exist, again, given the nature of the indentured nature of it. However, what they're not advocating for, which is what most migrant workers are advocating for and migrant worker organizations are advocating for, is status upon arrival. So rather than saying we don't want migrants or migrant workers, which is what a lot of unions and, you know, the traditional left is saying, what migrant justice organizers are advocating for is actually what we want is open visas for migrant workers to have permanent residency upon arrival, because that is precisely what makes them precarious. And if we shut down the migrant worker program without actually looking at all of these other barriers that exist to immigration, without looking at the global economy as to why people are migrating and why it is that increasingly, you know, of course, it's not a coincidence that people from the global south are the ones who are migrant workers, because, you know, migrant worker programs are basically the flip side of outsourcing, right? It's the insourcing of precarious labor that's needed. If we're not looking at labor in an internationalist way, if we're not looking at the economy in an internationalist way and the ways in which we're bound up in these kinds of violences of capital, then we're basically shutting the door to labor in the global south and to those conditions that create labor in the global south to be in such precarity. So I think it's really important to be aware of the ways in which that kind of division and nationalism creates wedges. It actually puts migrant workers in a far more precarious position, because then, you know, that's why they end up resorting to more irregular means of travel and journey, as we're seeing all around the
world.
Yeah,
and as maybe a last point and a small ray of hope in some ways, I mean, if we can call it that, the report Never Home came out at a pretty opportune time, in the sense that this was when, you know, the refugee crisis, which has been ongoing for years, has started making sort of front page news around the world. It seems like there's this moment now where, on the one hand, you know, there's an ever-growing number of refugees, but finally we're seeing some kind of solidarity actions. We saw some refugees welcome protests in Toronto. How does this very sort of more acute crisis fit into what you're saying, and what could Canada do in response? And what kind of solidarity, you know, is coming from the grassroots?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the grassroots, there's been an immense response in the context of Canada. We have over 29, almost 30 cities who over the past week on very short notice organized refugees welcome mobilizations in their communities, you know, as far north as Inuvik and all across the country, east to west. And that's, you know, incredibly inspiring. And of course, this is happening in the context of global mobilizations today in Europe. There's refugee welcome mobilizations across the continent. And so for me, it's as someone who's been organizing in this movement for a really long time, it's been actually quite shocking in a good way to see communities across Canada chant things like open borders, you know, because that would be seen as quite a radical response. But at the same time, so in contrast rather to, you know, and at the same time as this grassroots mobilization and really this outpouring of empathy and solidarity across Canada and around the world, the Canadian government has had a really disgusting and shameful response. So, you know, on the one hand, Harper has been saying things like, we can't open up our borders because refugees are terrorists, and that has been the refrain for decades. And so, you know, on the one hand, Harper has that kind of response, which is really fear-mongering. On the other hand, Harper is saying, you know, the way to resolve the refugee crisis is increasing military action, so continuing Canada's imperial legacy and imperialist interventions by continuing a campaign of military action, which has been condemned even at the level of the United Nations. And on the other hand, you know, gesturing towards taking in more refugees, when in fact, again, Canada, as I've mentioned, has made it increasingly hard for refugees to come to Canada. And it really goes to show the immense amount of dogmatic attachment that they have to a racist, anti-migrant, anti-refugee agenda. Because, you know, even though this policy is receiving a lot of backlash from people who previously, to be honest, didn't really care about refugee issues, government is adamant in its stand of military intervention and not accepting refugees.
That was author and activist Harsha Walia talking about Canada's increasingly cruel immigration system. Next, my conversation with Quebec activist Roger Rachy about the wave of strikes about to hit that province. Roger, there might be not too much awareness of this in the rest of Canada, but it's actually shaping up to be a pretty hot autumn in Quebec this year, with the looming showdown between the public sector workers whose contracts have already expired and a Quebec government that's quite determined to implement new austerity measures. What's the background, first of all, to what's happening, and then what's actually going to happen in the fall, you know, in rough outline?
Well, the battle has been looming for at least a year. Mm-hmm. Last fall already, there were several major demonstrations, several actions taken, not only by trade unions, but also by community groups, environmental groups, etc., all against the cutbacks and all against the austerity measures announced by the federal government. During the spring, actually, there was a peak in the mobilization, and 800 community groups went on strike across Quebec. That was the first time we had seen any such action by community groups, and especially at that wider scale. At the same time, about 15 teachers in colleges walked out also. All that was on May Day, walked out at the same time. So you could see the battle brewing, and you could see the battle lines being drawn. As we move towards this fall, all these actors are back on the scene. The trade unions more than ever, because, as you say, the public sector contracts are up. First up are all the education, teachers and staff in educational, in colleges, universities, high schools, etc. And mass actions are being prepared as of September 1st, whether it's meeting with teachers, meeting with parents, whether it's picket lines outside, taking strike votes. We expect the strike votes to basically call for some form of industrial action around the end of October, beginning of November. Mm. So that's as far as the trade unions go. At the same time, the students are gearing up for major demonstration and possibly strikes, also beginning of November. And the community groups are calling for, again, a week of action in early November and possibility of, again, striking. So end October, beginning of November, looks like it's going to be a very hot time to come back.
Is this an echo or a sort of another buildup of what we saw in 2012 with Maple Spring? What's different? What's the same? Where is this sort of energy coming from, and why now?
It's different from 2012 in the sense that you have a lot more people directly involved. In 2012, it was mostly the students, mm-hmm. obviously, and then those who supported the students against the government. This time, it's very widespread. It's practically every organization of a social nature in Quebec, whether it's unions, community groups, environmental groups, practically everybody is being hit by the cutback. So the potential participation in mass actions is much bigger than the 200,000 or 300,000 students. It literally goes into the hundreds of thousands, probably close to a million people. That's one. At the same time, it is so varied. The interests are so different and the groups are so different from one another that it's much more difficult to align them on a common strategy and a common set of actions. So the potential is huge, but on the other hand, the obstacles are also immense.
What can they hope to accomplish? Like where is the common ground other than, you know, a very general thing of being against austerity? Is there room to actually push this government, and where are the sort of strategic links that can be drawn between?
Yeah, that is obviously the question. The question which has been I would say, the heart of all these demonstrations and all this mobilization for a year has been, up to what point can the government be pushed? And is there any way in which this government can be brought to its senses or even pushed back on austerity? It's hard to say because we're in the beginning of the mandate, right? Mm. Only 1 year into the mandate, the second year is just starting. The satisfaction with the government has risen. And it's around 50 to 60% level, which is important. There's a couple of by-elections coming up, but nothing really major to threaten the government. So the question really becomes, up to what point enough social disturbance can be created in Quebec to force the government to rethink some of its policies. And it's a very difficult point to assess. I think what is being put forward to all the participants in that incredibly diverse anti-austerity movement is that unless one struggles today, one never knows to what degree you're going to be pushed back by the government and how far the austerity measures are going to go. It is so severe, so pronounced, so deep, that unless one stands up right now and does its utmost to block it or reverse some of it, what might happen in the next few years would be incredibly devastating. So it's difficult to assess. What we're trying to do, I think, is to make as much as possible, these movements converge around some common sets of demands and austerity, increased taxation of the wealthier groups in society, of course, increased taxation of corporations, and in this way, respond to the deficit, which is not that big, by the way, but still respond to the deficit. So there's some common demands. The question of common action is really difficult to get to. Community groups have gone on strike and are willing to go on strike. Students have demonstrated that they could go on strike. Up to what point the public sector,
right, the unions,
can be brought to strike is difficult to assess. In the educational sphere, possible. In health, there are so many incredibly repressive laws that could totally destroy unions that obviously before engaging in walkouts in the health sector, one has to be very sure as to what you can achieve. The more radical elements in the trade union movements are putting forward a two-step strategy. Organize walkouts in the education sphere, i.e. schools, and then around that, maybe bring in some elements of the health sector, either in regional strike or some supporting strike. But it has to be a fairly elaborated tactical arrangement so as to not to basically fall into the trap and then open the door to massive destruction of the social movements.
Right. And actually, speaking of the health sector unions, that's something we saw in BC after the first Liberal government in the early 2000s. So it's definitely something that's possible. Is there more general sort of fear of repression as well? I mean, we saw the repression of the police, of the student strikes. We've seen these sort of laws come in here in Quebec that are quite draconian, as to, right of assembly and all these kinds of things. Is that having an effect?
Yes, it has. For example, all those contemplating the possibility of striking in the educational field are already discussing what to do in case a special law is adopted, forcing people back to work in schools, universities, high schools, etc. Some of the ideas put forward are interesting, which is to try and revive the kind of movement that we saw in 2012, the famous casserole movement, i.e. masses of people coming out in support for those who are on the front lines with the government. Of course, it's hard to predict how that is going to pan out. It's an interesting idea, but part of that movement in 2012 was very spontaneous.
Right.
And it's very difficult to recreate a spontaneous
support. Not something you can just create.
Exactly. So it's an interesting idea, but remains to be seen up to what point it can be brought into fruition. So that is an issue. In health, it's always been the question, because the penalties, both in terms of the unions and the individual members going out on illegal strikes, are incredible. I mean, they range into the tens of thousands of dollars. They range into heavy fines. They range into incarceration, prison terms, etc., which means that if you do anything there, you have to be sure that you've got your support and the correlation of forces allows you to.
Yeah. And what's the relationship with, maybe we could call the official sort of political sphere. You've been
active
in Quebec. So there we have this provincial party that's, you know, unique on the Canadian scale, that's actually put anti-austerity strongly at its center. What's the strength of this party today? What's its relationship to the social movements and all that we've talked about so far? And what
Quebec Solidaire has is the only party that has supported from beginning and throughout up until today the anti-austerity movement. There's obviously support coming from our elected members in Parliament. They're the only people who stand up and who support time after time the various groups, either mobilizing, demonstrating, or on strike against the government. And that will continue. Inside the social movements, a factor which is not well known is up to what point people that are close to Quebec Solidaire play sort of a leading role,
right,
both inside the community groups, in some other trade unions, etc., in order to, one, make the movements converge, and two, push or propose radical means of action, right, striking, demonstration, convergence, etc. And Quebec Solidaire is not very forthcoming in making that clear. So it's a very funny situation where sometimes you can be sitting in a room full of 50, 60, 70 people from different mass organizations around Quebec. And looking around the room, you can recognize half of them as being close or among Quebec Solidaire, but the party officially will not be mentioned.
But they won't act sort of in concert,
exactly,
or, right?
Exactly, exactly. Now, for the first time, Quebec Solidaire is calling for a meeting of activists in the public sector, sometime this fall, to look at common strategies. So there's a beginning of consciousness of, you know, sort of the need to have some form of discussion among Quebec Solidaire activists, and a recognition that a lot of them do play a crucial role. How will that come about remains to be seen, but I think it's the beginning of an important development. It's been very difficult in Quebec because there's a tradition of neutrality.
Right.
Among social organizations. Part of it has been because of the right-wing past of some of these organizations. Part of it has been because of a refusal to fall in step with the Parti Québécois.
Right.
Part of it has been hypocritical. People who affirm neutrality, in fact, do support the Parti Québécois. So there's a difficult situation around open political support, but it's something that Quebec Solidaire is working on very gradually.
And maybe as a very last thing, what's the impact of all of this, both on the federal election campaign and the impact of the federal election campaign on what's happening in Quebec? I mean, in some ways, it seems
parallel
but also quite removed. Like, what's
very interestingly, since the People's Social Forum, which was held in August of 2014, the fight against the Harper government and raft of right-wing measures coming from the federal government has been integrated in the Quebec anti-austerity movement. For example, there was a systematic attempt to bring in environmental groups, knowing full well that their battle wasn't so much with the provincial government. Of course, there's some elements of battle with the provincial government, but it was mostly with the federal government. Yet there was an attempt to bring them in, and an attempt to work in the critique of the federal government, particularly the Harper Conservatives, on the question of climate, on the question of anti-union laws, etc.
Right.
Now, the elections happening in October this year have been worked into the plan of action of the anti-austerity movement.
Hmm.
There's quite a few activities that will happen from now till October 19th of various actors in the anti-austerity movement against the federal government. Either bird-dogging, you know, the federal leaders and asking them questions regarding their policies, or holding demonstrations when there are debates on TV, so on and so forth. So I think for the first time in 20 or 30 years, we see an attempt to kind of work in that aspect in the anti-austerity movement.
That was social and political activist Roger Rachy giving an account of the political situation in Quebec heading into this fall. That's all for this week. Talk to you again in 2 weeks.